It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonprofit newsroom ProPublica reports on Wisconsin's undocumented immigrants who break the law by driving a vehicle, risking tickets, or even being arrested or deported. As we discuss undocumented immigrants prohibited by state law from getting driver's license, call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa Sanchez is one of two ProPublica reporters behind this investigation into the conditions of undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin. Melissa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You calculated the number of Hispanic drivers cited for driving without a license in several Wisconsin counties last year, and you found Hispanic drivers cited at a disproportionate rate. What did this investigation reveal around the state?
Well, what it showed is something that a lot of Hispanic immigrant drivers will tell you without looking at the numbers, that they are being ticketed over and over and over all over the state for driving without a license. And when you go to court, depending on where you are in the county, almost everybody that you'll see for that charge of driving without a license is going to be an immigrant from Latin America. So statewide, we found that in the circuit court system, nearly half of all of the convictions for driving without a license went to Hispanic drivers. But we suspect that the number is actually higher because very often people who are Hispanic are marked as white in police or court records. And when I say more than half, that's out of 16,000 in just a single year.
How much are these citations?
So it depends on where you get the ticket in the state and what agency gives it to you and whether it's your first or a second or a third. They can start at $124 each ticket at a municipal court. But once you get a second ticket, they escalate. And if the first ticket is issued by a sheriff's department, then they start at $200. But so it's either $124 or $200, then it goes to $300, $400, and then close to $500 per citation.
That is a lot of money, a lot of wages for someone perhaps making minimum wage in Wisconsin.
It's a lot. It's easily a week's worth of wages for some folks after they're on a repeat offense. And you know, to be clear, a lot of the dairy workers are making more than minimum wage. We found between $10.50 and $16 about what folks are making in different parts of the state. But it's worth noting that in agriculture, there's no extra overtime wages. And so that means there's no time and a half pay after working 40 hours. And routinely, people are working 60 or 70 hour weeks.
In the last year, ProPublica spoke to more than 100 undocumented current and former dairy workers. And you wanted to see how Wisconsin's ban on undocumented driver's licenses is affecting their lives. What did they tell you? What did you learn?
So it was really fascinating because we went into this project thinking we were going to write about just about labor conditions, about accidents at work, access to healthcare, and we are still writing about that. But the number one concern that folks had was this issue of not being able to drive, the inability to drive legally, and the constant fear and threat of getting ticketed and fined and the possibility of arrest meant that a lot of workers feel trapped on the farms where they work and very often live. And if your listeners don't know, dairy workers, immigrant dairy workers, often live in trailers or in old farmhouses, like right on the property of the farm where they milk cows or where they scrape manure. And they do that because they know that if they get behind the wheels, they are likely to get ticketed and they can't afford it. And so as a result, folks, like I said, they work 60, 70 hour weeks. They don't leave the farms. They maybe will leave once every 2 weeks to cash in their checks and send money home. But it's a life of extreme isolation for some folks, or they take the risk and they go out and they drive and sometimes they'll get ticketed.
Melissa Sanchez with us, reporter at ProPublica, talking about their investigation on Wisconsin's driver's license laws and how it affects undocumented residents. You can join in with your questions, your concerns at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Melissa, Jose is a Honduran immigrant, former dairy worker living in central Wisconsin, received a handful of tickets for driving without a license in the 2 years since he immigrated here. And we're going to hear a bit from Jose.
El poli desde que ve que uno es hispano te para.
Cops see that you're Hispanic. They stop you and in Wisconsin, they give you a ticket for not having a license. So then we're screwed, because sometimes we can't even afford food. Sometimes we can't pay the rent. And then we get a $200 or $250 ticket.
You shared this recording of Jose. How common are stories like his?
So common. Like I said, we've spoken with more than 100 workers. And, you know, I've walked into break rooms on farms and I'll just ask, has anybody here been ticketed for not having a license? And everybody will tell me yes. Mm-hmm. If you're undocumented in this state, you're like, I don't think I've met a single undocumented person who's driven here and not gotten a ticket.
There was a dairy farmer in western Wisconsin said you can't call an Uber because there isn't any. How much of an issue is the rural setting?
It's a really, really big component of this. So similar issues are playing out in Madison and Milwaukee, but to a lesser extent, because things are closer. You can walk, you can take the bus to places. And when there's more people around, it might be easier to get a ride to a restaurant where you work or a factory. But in rural settings, people are just in extreme isolation. I visited in one place where a worker told me, you know, he lives three and a half hours from Madison and Milwaukee, and he's never visited there, and he's lived in the state for 10 years. It's really hard for folks to get around. They've never seen the beautiful parts of Wisconsin. Like, it's just, it's really incredible. Or they'll have to depend on their bosses for a ride. The rural component, the lack of public transportation, and kind of to add on to it, it's not just that. Folks are working these really difficult shifts. They work, let's say, 4 to 5 hours during one milking shift and then have 4 or 5 hours off and then have to work again and then another little break and then they work again. They're not getting, you know, a full 8 hours of sleep at night. They're working in the middle of the night. But those odd shifts also complicate their ability to leave the farm.
I want to go back to one point you made, that information you collected found roughly half of the 16,000 circuit court convictions for driving without a valid license in Wisconsin involved Hispanic drivers. And you've said the actual total is likely higher. Why is that?
It's so people who are Hispanic come in all colors. You know, I'm brown. I have, my husband's white. People are black. So police officers often race is just complicated. And so folks mm-hmm. often will mark people who are Hispanic as white. And so that was the case in Madison, for example, when I, in addition to the circuit court records, we also requested records from municipal courts across the state because cases can also be seen there. And we wanted to make sure that what we were seeing in circuit court wasn't an anomaly. And in places like Madison, we learned that police or the courts are often marking Hispanic people as white. There were barely any Hispanics in, according to the data that I got. But then when you look at the last names, their last names like mine, they're Sanchez, they're Gonzalez, they're Cortez. And so there we wound up using a different way to calculate the number of Hispanic folks in places like Madison that were ticketed, and found that it was, I think, around 36% last year. And as you know, Madison is not 36% Hispanic. I think it's about 8%.
ProPublica reporter Melissa Sanchez investigating the Wisconsin law banning undocumented immigrants from obtaining driver's license and its effects on our state. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We unpack a ProPublica investigation that examines the state law banning undocumented immigrants from getting driver's license and the ripple effect that has on our state. According to estimates from Migration Policy Institute, about 70,000 undocumented immigrants live here in Wisconsin. That's more than the number of people who live in Eau Claire. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, add a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. ProPublica reporter Melissa Sanchez stays with us. Melissa, we heard from Cindy in Menominee Falls, called in to ask, what is the rationale to not allow these workers to get driver's license?
That's a good question. So in the mid-2000s, there was a federal law that was passed in response to 9/11 that changed the requirements for the ID that could be used to board airplanes. And the idea was, because licenses are so commonly used as identification in this country, to have states require that folks show proof of citizenship or some legal status in this country that could prove their identity in order to board planes or enter a federal building and the buildings. And the idea was to try to prevent foreigners from committing acts of terror. So when that happened, Wisconsin and other states that had previously allowed undocumented folks to get driver's licenses stopped doing that.
Fast forward to today, what do you hear from state and local officials about letting undocumented immigrants legally drive?
So I spent a long time trying to get Republicans in the state to talk to me and to explain why this law remains in place and why they think it's a good idea. And it was really difficult to get somebody from the Republican side to articulate their support for this. Instead, what I found when I showed up to places and I talked to, you know, I spent some time in central Wisconsin, in Abbotsford in particular, which is a community that has a meatpacking facility that employs a lot of undocumented immigrants. It's close to a lot of dairy. And everybody there, from the municipal court judge to the mayor to the police chief to the local lawmakers, all told me they think the law should change. So I, you know, and they're, one of the reasons that's happening is that immigrant rights groups are showing up to these places. They're having conversations with lawmakers and with dairy farmers and with all the folks who kind of interact with undocumented people who are driving anyway. And I think in some parts of the state, they're starting to convince lawmakers to, you know, to see things differently. I think. But it's, you know, this law has been in place for 15 years. So I don't know if that's a naive optimism that I'm expressing right here.
Let's bring on a call. Barb in Door County is here. Barb, hi.
Hi. I was aware of this issue, but not the extent of it. And I'm very concerned that, to me, this is legalizing racism, because they're targeting people. And since many of them work at the dirty jobs that no one else wants in the dairy industry, and we're the dairy state, it's putting a whole new slant on. I was going to take my grandkids for ice cream today, and thinking of them eating an ice cream cone, which is probably helped to be produced by people who are targeted racially like that.
Barb,
it's putting a whole new slant on it.
Barb, thank you so much for calling in. Melissa, what about racial profiling here?
I'm so glad Barb brought that up. So when you talk to immigrants who've been ticketed, half of them will tell you that they feel that they've been racially profiled, if not more. They'll tell you about times they've been stopped, they've been driving under the speed limit, and then out of nowhere, a cop pulls them over, and their only citation is not having a license. They're not being ticketed for speeding, they're not being ticketed for running a red light. And so that's what a lot of them think is happening. And that might be the case, but what we found is a bit more complicated. So the police officers and sheriff's deputies all across the state routinely will just run the license plates of cars that pass by, you know, the license plates of cars driven by white people, Black people, Latino people. And if the check of the plates turns up something funny that might give them probable cause to stop the car. And what do I mean by that? It could be an arrest warrant that's tied to the registered vehicle owner. It could be that the registered vehicle owner has a revoked license for drinking and driving. And what's often the case with Hispanic drivers is that the check will turn out that the registered owner of the vehicle doesn't have a license. And this kind of speaks to this greater contradiction or hypocrisy in state law and policy that allows undocumented people to legally buy a car, register with the state, get those license plates that say very proudly America's Dairyland, but they're not allowed to drive them. And so I don't know if it's racial profiling or if it's actually the system working just as intended. I think a lot of police officers are just doing their job. And when they do encounter somebody who is driving without a license, they feel compelled by the law to enforce the law. And for the recipient of the ticket, it feels like something different. And I do want to be clear that it's not that all of these undocumented people are driving around perfectly and that they've never committed a driving infraction. A lot of them do. A lot of them are speeding, or they're doing the same things that all the rest of us are doing. But I'd say in a third to half of the cases that I reviewed, and I've reviewed hundreds of cases, that it's often just a random check of a license plate that turns up this infraction of driving without a license.
We're talking about how Wisconsin's driver's license laws affect undocumented residents with Melissa Sanchez, Melissa, reporter for ProPublica. You can join in with your question, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth now in Jefferson. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Good morning. Last summer, my husband was in, I had an accident with somebody who was an undocumented person who also obviously didn't have a driver's license then. And it was horrific, as you can imagine. But thankfully, he made it. He's still with us. But one of the things that we struggled with and we still think about is if this person had the opportunity to go through the typical licensing process, which also includes obviously the driver's education, would this accident have happened? And now I know that any of us can get into an accident regardless if we have a license or not. But it's something that we talk about a lot because we think the decision that was made that caused the accident might have been something that would not have happened had that person gone through driver's education. And so I'm in full support of giving people as much information to drive correctly as possible.
Elizabeth, thank you for sharing that story. Melissa, public safety on the roads and the impact. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm really sorry to hear about that accident. I think that's a really good point, and it's what I've heard repeatedly from police chiefs, police officers, sheriff's deputies, that you have a lot of folks who come to this country and, because of the rural nature of where they live and work, they are suddenly they feel like they have to drive. But in their home countries, they never got behind the wheel before. A lot of these folks are coming from places where it's not common to own a car. Cars are really expensive. And so they are relatively new drivers who don't understand the rules of the road, and they never got tested because the state doesn't. I mean, because they can't in a state. So I think one of the biggest selling points for the folks who want to change the law is that there's some evidence in other parts of the country that when you do allow undocumented people to get, trained and tested and prove that they can drive and then get licenses, they will do that. And then there's fewer accidents. And there's also another thing. I don't know if this happened to Elizabeth's husband, but a lot of undocumented people can't afford car insurance because car insurance costs more when you don't have a license. The insurance company is taking a bigger risk on you because you're not a proven licensed driver. So insurance rates go up, and folks are already spending, a couple hundred dollars here and there on tickets. They can't afford to also add a couple hundred dollars more on insurance. So there's some research that shows that when you do allow undocumented people to get trained, tested, licensed, they will also get insurance, and that hopefully will make things better for everybody on the road.
Is there concern from critics that undocumented immigrants could vote illegally by having a driver's license? Is that a valid critique of this?
I mean, I don't know how valid of a critique that is, how often that happens, but what I've heard from Republicans in Wisconsin that they would do if they did allow undocumented people to drive is to put in bright letters at the top of their license not to be used for voting. Mm-hmm. So to try to figure out a way to make those licenses very different from the licenses that U.S. citizens are able to get in Wisconsin, so that there's no confusion at the voting booths. And I mean, I don't want to get into a discussion about whether the voting fraud arguments are real or not, but I haven't heard of a lot of evidence that this is a widespread issue in states like where I live in Illinois, where undocumented people can drive.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Melissa Sanchez is a reporter at ProPublica who focuses on immigrants and low-wage workers. You can find a link to the series of ProPublica reports on Wisconsin's undocumented immigrants. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a bankruptcy tactic to potentially shield executives from liability as the U.S. Supreme Court blocks a nationwide settlement with opioid banker Purdue Pharma. Wisconsin's Attorney General announced 2 years ago a proposed resolution of our state's bankruptcy claims against the Sackler family and their company, Purdue Pharma. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email questions about bankruptcy to ideas@WPR.org. Ralph Anzavino is a Marquette University Law School professor teaching business bankruptcy law. Ralph, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Good to talk with you.
Good morning. So the Supreme Court temporarily blocking Purdue Pharma from a $6 billion bankruptcy deal that would have shielded the Sackler family from future opioid lawsuits. Why would justices block this deal?
I think the this is a common problem or issue in all bankruptcies. We experienced this same issue here in Wisconsin in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee case, where the claimants, the plaintiffs, same as in this case with Purdue Pharma, the issue is are you putting in enough money in order to be able to have the court approve the bankruptcy plan? And there are four basic circumstances that put a business in bankruptcy or reorganization. And one of them is what we call tort litigation, which is some kind of litigation that's going on. We know that what's driving the Purdue bankruptcy is tort litigation because of the OxyContin. And so this is a common issue in every bankruptcy where the problem that the business is trying to solve is tort litigation. And so I think, as you mentioned, the Sackler family was going to put in $6 billion. And in return for that, they were going to get a no suit. In other words, no one could sue them. What happens is, and this all started with Johns Manville, when Johns Manville had all the asbestos problems, and there were also tons and tons of lawsuits. And so what happens is, the way this is solved is they create a trust, and this is not just in the Purdue case, but in every case where there's tort litigation. They create a trust and they put X amount of dollars in the trust, and then they tell all the plaintiffs, all the claimants, all the litigants, you have to go and sue this trust and prove your case, and then you'll receive monies. So the magic question is, and this is this is all actuarial, mm-hmm. How many plaintiffs do we have, mm-hmm. and how much do you think they're going to recover? And that would determine how much money you're going to put into that trust fund. And so the issue is, as it was in the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, where we had all that litigation, is how much money do we put into this trust? And then what happens is all the litigation kind of leaves the business, and the business puts the money into the trust, and then all the litigants go over and litigate in the trust. And then they appoint a person to kind of manage that trust. And so they do this in every case where there's where there's litigation. So over the years, think of the Archdiocese, think of the asbestos with Johns Manville, the Dow Corning suits with the breast implants, Johnson & Johnson right now with baby powder. So the real simple answer, I realize that was more than you wanted.
No, no, that's okay.
The simple answer is get out the dart and let's throw it at the target. And how much money do we need? I mean, you're talking about, you know, how many known plaintiffs are there? How much should they fairly recover? How long is it going to take? Do they have good cases? Do they have bad cases? And so that's the issue the Supreme Court is going to be looking at, is whether the Sacklers, in order to receive immunity from future litigation, they have to put in X amount of dollars. And the question is $6 billion the number? That's the issue.
And we'll get to the Archdiocese of Milwaukee in a moment. But going back to the person managing the trust, because isn't it the U.S. trustee who filed this suit, the Justice Department's, you know, bankruptcy watchdog? And I'm just wondering, you know, who are they and what are they doing here in this particular case?
Well, yes, the government is involved in it.
Yeah.
The U.S. trustee is what I guess we would call the ombudsman.
Okay.
They're supposed to keep an eye on things and make sure they represent the public at large and make sure that this is a fair and a treatment, that this entity is getting treated like all others. And so that's who's raising the issue. Interestingly, in your question, you ask who will be the person that will monitor this fund.
Yes.
If they get, and they will get to a number, and then the number will be whatever the number is. I've been asked on several occasions to be that person to monitor those funds. The most recent one was mesothelioma. And I kind of backed off on that. I chose not to do that. That's a very tough job. You can imagine, how do I know how much money to pay person X when they prove their case, but yet have enough money left over for some other person that might come down the road? I mean, how many plaintiffs do we know are going to come out of the woodwork once this thing is set up, right? I mean, it's almost an impossible task to decide that. And so that's the purpose of the U.S. trustee, is saying, I don't think this is enough money, right? That's what they're saying. And then the Sacklers and their counsel are going to say, well, we anticipate X amount of people. You're saying it's much larger. We're saying it's much smaller. I mean, that's why we have court systems to figure out exactly what that is, because you can't go back. You can't go back and say, well, in 2023, we kind of missed the target. Now you got to pony up another $5 billion. So this is a one and done. So they got to get it right.
The Justice Department says the Sackler family is using Chapter 11 bankruptcy to protect family members from more lawsuits. How common is that strategy among Chapter 11 filers?
Oh, it's exceedingly common. I mean, that's the whole, as far as the people who are kind of satellites around the case, they want to be insulated. They want to say, okay, I'm here. Maybe I have, maybe I don't have responsibility. That's a legal question, but we're willing to get it resolved by putting in X amount of dollars. So this is in every case that where you have, remember, tort litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the person is putting the money in. That's what they're paying, basically, to get the insulation from future litigation.
And if the Sacklers are successful at shielding themselves from future lawsuits, what could that mean for Wisconsin communities hoping to receive settlement money in the years to come?
Well, it's pretty much the same question. That is obviously those communities want the Sacklers to put in as much money as as would cover all the claims that they might have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard for, you know, none of us have a crystal ball. So we don't know how much that is. We don't know how many other claimants. Remember, not only besides the communities, you have individuals and family members who died. I mean, these are serious claims here. And so it's looking at that crystal ball, trying to figure out, and it's not anything unusual. It's in all the cases I mentioned to you, Dow Corning, Johns Manville, Johnson & Johnson with their baby powders. That's the same issue. So that issue comes up. It's the same issue in the Archdiocese case. How much money should we put in to solve the tort litigants?
We're talking about business bankruptcies with Ralph Anzavino, who is a Marquette University Law School professor. You can join in the conversation, call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Ralph, Chapter 11, Standard Bankruptcy Code for most businesses. When would a business want or need to file under Chapter 11?
That's one of the magic questions. In fact, that's the answer to that question is the one thing that most businesses, and when I talk about businesses, I'm not talking about GM or the large Walmart, the large companies. Here in Wisconsin, we basically have small to medium-sized businesses. And so it's the same for you and I as individuals. And that is okay, I have money coming in, I have money going out. And when you get to the point where you no longer can handle the stress and the financial demands of what situation you're in, you have to seek help. And so you do that when you're an individual by filing for bankruptcy relief or seeking bankruptcy help. And the same thing for a business. And what happens is it's not so much critical for individuals, but for businesses, you have to do it sooner rather than later. And the big mistake is for businesses is to wait too long, because the longer you wait, the less opportunity there will be for your bankruptcy attorney to kind of help you correct the problem. And remember, we've only talked about one of the problems,
mm-hmm.
and that's tort litigation. There's several others which are the primary causes for why a business files for bankruptcy relief. And so the major problem is the bankruptcy attorney will normally say to the business client, geez, I wish you would have come in last year when things weren't as dire as they are now. And so And your question is when is that moment? The only one that's going to know that is you or I when we're individuals, or a business person. This is what they do. This is their life. This is what they own.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they do every day when they get up and they think about every night when they go to bed. And so you have to exercise good judgment and say, you know, I don't see any light at the end of this tunnel. I don't know what's going to happen. Short of a miracle, I think we need somebody to help us. And so that's the million-dollar question is, and again, the best response is sooner rather than later.
Ralph Anzavino teaches business bankruptcy at Marquette University Law School as we look at the implications of bankruptcy protections on firms. And you can be part of this discussion along the way. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine how companies may use bankruptcy courts as a way to limit liability and how some firms continue operations after going through the process. There's room to discuss aspects of business bankruptcy in Wisconsin and beyond. Call in with a question or concern, 800-642-1234. We have Marquette University Law School Professor Ralph Anzavino, who is here. Let's bring in Jane in Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I'd ask him to speak to the strange way the laws are written, where credit card debt and student loan debt cannot be absolved when people go bankrupt.
Jane, thanks for that. And that sounds like personal bankruptcy, Ralph.
Sure. No. Yeah, no problem. let's see. Let's separate those two things out. First of all, credit card debt. Let's talk about that one first. Credit card debt is probably the most common debt that one has when one files for bankruptcy, and that is dischargeable. So that you need to remember that. So that is a dischargeable debt. Sometimes those debts might not be dischargeable if, for example, you used your credit card to buy what we would call, what the law calls, luxury goods. So in other words, you can't go out and buy some jewelry and then go on your credit card and then go file bankruptcy. That the courts are going to say, no, you know, the credit card was to be, you know, food, clothing, shelter, essential things, not luxury goods. So 99.9%, that's why when you go in to talk to a bankruptcy lawyer, they will ask you to bring in your credit card bills because they want to look and see whether you've been purchasing luxury goods. That's one of the reasons. There's a number of others. Now, student loans, when I first came to Marquette in 76, and when I was practicing, I came from Ohio and then came to Wisconsin, which I, by the way, I love dearly. Student loans were dischargeable when I first started practicing law, but then Congress decided that we didn't want to finance that. And so that was your individual personal choice to spend the money to get this better education, which therefore theoretically would lead to a better job. And so Congress made student loan debt non-dischargeable, but it's not an impossible task. Even student loan debt can be discharged if you can show hardship. And so there, if you can show to the court, judge, we call it the Bruner test in, under the law, but if you can show that the person has limited income and they're pretty much where they're going to be, in other words, there's no prospect to make a lot more money, and they're going to be pretty much stuck in this situation, the court could discharge the debt because it's going to be a hardship for this person going forward. So that's where both credit cards and student debt are. So credit cards, remember, that debt is dischargeable. So you want to make sure you understand that. Mm-hmm. For all people listening, you can, yes, you can get, that's one of the reasons why you're there. And then of course, student loans is also can be discharged, but generally you start the opposite, and that is it's not dischargeable unless you can prove otherwise. I hope that was helpful.
That was helpful. Let's turn to the State Department of Justice saying it wants to see records of the Milwaukee Archdiocese sealed in a 2011 bankruptcy filing. And the department says the records are part of its investigation into sexual abuse by faith leaders. Why could bankruptcy records be under seal?
Well, I don't think there's any difference for bankruptcy records than any other records. You have that debate going on now in a lot of Donald Trump's litigation as to whether things should be sealed or not be sealed. And whether it's bankruptcy court or tax court or civil court, it doesn't really matter. It's the same exact concept. And that is there really some basis or some primary reason why these records should be kept from the public? Frankly, in my opinion, and I'm not involved in the dispute, I don't know what possible good reason there would be. Depends, I guess, on what was sealed. Mm-hmm. I don't know I don't know exactly what the argument is on why those records were sealed. There was obviously some reason why the bankruptcy judge did that. And now the question is the demand for those records greater than, of course, what the reason was originally to seal them? And I don't know.
Sure. I wonder, is there precedent for state, you know, justice departments to get access to confidential claims that are sealed in bankruptcy courts? You know, can a justice department get that access and be looped in?
Well, the answer to that is can I convince the judge, right? I mean, the answer is always yes. But then you have to go to court and convince a judge that your reason for seeking those records is greater than the reason. And, you know, after the passage of time, I'm trying to think now, it must be 10 to 15 years now, and of course my time may be wrong, but it's been quite a while since the Archdiocese case closed up. So maybe with the passage of time, the demand or the reason for that isn't as great as it once was. So I guess we're going to find out. That's going to be a decision by the bankruptcy court. And then, of course, it'll be, I assume it'll be appealed from there.
Ralph Anzavino with us, Marquette University Law School professor, as we talk about business bankruptcies and the like. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Ralph, turning to farm bankruptcies, last year WPR says Wisconsin saw a 72% decline in farm bankruptcies from the previous year. Is that a reliable measure for how farms are doing currently?
Well, that I think in a general principle, yes. But remember, the one caveat that I suggested to you is that many people who should file bankruptcy wait. It's just there's something in us. It's like going to the doctor. A lot of people just wait too long to go to the doctor. And there's something in us that says, okay, I'm going to get up tomorrow morning. I'm going to do the same thing I did yesterday. And so... yes, that's true. I agree. As a general principle, that means that probably that we're not doing as badly as one might suspect. On the other hand, and I don't know, I assume you followed that story. We had millions of gallons of milk just spilled into the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District in the last, I'd have to say, the last 30 days or 40 days, and so there is some tension, there is some problem in the system, at least for on the dairy side of it. So like everything else, it's all been in flux. Almost all you mentioned that the farm bankruptcies are down. On the other hand, Chapter 11 bankruptcies are way up. Huh. They're up to 70% in the last 6 months. So
what might be that due to? We only have, about 30 seconds left here. Why would you see such an uptick there?
Well, I think it was the pandemic. Huh. My son lost his restaurant due to the pandemic. So I think everybody knows somebody who lost their business. Certainly restaurants were probably the most difficult, most hit the worst because they had to close up. So a lot of businesses were just destroyed by the pandemic. And so I think we're seeing the reverberations and the echoes of the pandemic still in our system.
I wonder very quickly here, what will you be watching for when oral arguments are expected to happen in the appeal of the Purdue Pharma settlement?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what the arguments are about regarding the number of plaintiffs that they expect, because it's all about that number. It's all about that 6 billion.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be that calculation by an actuarial person saying, okay, we think this is the number that it should be, and therefore we should be 20 billion, that kind of thing.
Ralph, thank you for joining us.
No problem, I enjoyed it.
Ralph Anzavino, professor teaching business bankruptcy law at Marquette University Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.